And a Bad Quaker podcast where liberty is our mission. And today is Tuesday, January 22nd, 2013. And this is podcast number 264. With me today is Dave Ridley on the phone. And you probably know Dave from his YouTube presence. He has the Ridley Report on the YouTube and on YouTube, not the YouTube, but anyway, showing my age there. Dave Ridley of the Ridley Report, and Dave, welcome to BadQuaker.com.
Thanks, Ben.
Dave, how long have you been doing the Ridley Report?
Since 07, so I guess it would be 5 years.
And you're located in New Hampshire, part of the Free State Project. What were you doing prior to going to the Free State?
You mean professionally?
Correct.
I just worked at a TV station. I worked at a Fox affiliate in Dallas, and I've been there for about 6 years when I moved to New Hampshire. And I just stayed at Fox when I moved. I didn't have to really switch jobs exactly. I mean, I got my paycheck looked exactly the same. It was almost the same amount. It was just a different station. It was all owned by Fox, and I was well treated at both places right up until the moment they fired me for being an activist.
They actually fired. Did they say it that way?
No, well, yes, and then technically they weren't firing me because I was a freelancer in Boston at the time, but they, one day they just didn't renew my, I guess you might call it a monthly contract, I guess which would be kind of what a freelancer is on. One day they just didn't renew it, no warning, they just didn't renew it, and when I called to find out what was going on, they admitted to me right there on the phone, yeah, this is because of certain activism that you've done that we have a problem with. They hadn't said anything about it before. But you know, we're not mad at you. We're concerned that the station could be associated with this activism. And the activism they were most concerned about was the most controversial thing I've ever done, and that was my visits to the Ed Brown house. I don't know if you're familiar with the Brown situation, but there was a standoff in northern New Hampshire, and I went to the house twice in the middle of a standoff. And they didn't like that, even though they had gone to the house too. So they thought I was too close to Ed. I had known him for a long time. He was one of the first people who welcomed me to the state. He's a little nutty, but he had certain human rights, you know. And so anyway, that got me in trouble at work and got me booted out. They even admitted in writing that they had done it because of my activism, and they invited me to apply back again after 6 months if it had all blown over or whatever. But that never really worked out. So it's kind of complicated.
Wow.
I have no real hard feelings because they had treated me well every minute I was there. They don't have a responsibility to continue employing me. But it was not what I would have done if I had been in their position.
We should, if we have an unlimited quantity of time, we should probably talk about the Ed Brown thing because that's a topic on its own. But for the moment, now, you also did some journalism in Europe during the Bosnian conflict over there, right?
Yeah, I was there briefly. I speak Croatian. I don't have, like, an ethnic link, but I just became obsessed with the situation, you know, when I was a 20-something and that was all getting started up. To me, the Yugoslav wars were kind of like an echo of World War II, and I had been real interested in World War II, so I felt like I had a chance to see some history repeating, and it sure did repeat.
I was putting together some notes for an upcoming podcast on that topic, and, you know, I hate to say it, but I was really busy in the 90s, you know, working, earning a living, trying to feed my children and so forth, and I knew what was going on was really messed up, but I almost intentionally didn't follow along because you know, things like that can be painful the more you know about them. But now that I'm looking back at it and looking at the way it all came down and the influence of NATO and so forth, It's very disturbing.
Yeah, the worst thing about it is just it's kind of complicated. I remember writing to a friend who was in Zagreb, or in the Zagreb area, and mentioning to her that I was having this dream that I would have every few weeks. And in my dream, I would be getting in my car and driving just a few miles down the road to a place that was like Bosnia, right? Where there were the houses were all down and burned and people were all dead, you know, and I kept dreaming it over and over again. And now that I have a bigger picture, I think, of the world and what's going on, it seems like America really is trotting down almost exactly the same path that Yugoslavia went down in the 70s and the 80s. And there are already so many historical similarities between the two countries. It's just horrifying to think. I mean, it's scary. Back in the 90s, one of the first things I learned how to say when I learned to speak Croatian was Amerika je dosadan, which means America is boring. That was going to be my answer. If anybody had a question for me as to why I was in Croatia or Bosnia, that was going to be my first answer, and it was true. I was bored. I thought those drive-by shootings and gang warfare and stuff like that was not very interesting. It was, you know, pretty safe, you know, where I lived. That was the worst that you had to worry about. Places where entire towns were burning down, that was interesting to me, and I wanted to see it. And it was exciting, you know, and I was full of life, you know, when I was over there. It was like I just sprang to life. And I would be depressed when I would get back. Now it's the other way around. It's like, no, I don't want to ever see this again. You know, please don't. You know, that'll be one safe place that people can go. But really, you know, in America, yes, you know, there are safer places and more dangerous places. But I have this fear of this kind of thing, you know, enveloping the whole nation, just like it enveloped almost all of Yugoslavia.
And really, that's a real good comparison, because Yugoslavia was sort of a hodgepodge country of different cultures that were all sort of glued together by this government, you know, and a map that was drawn by dignitaries in a different country and just imposed upon people. But yet they were still, for almost a century, they held together as one country. And then it just seemed like, you know, at least from looking at it from the outside, it seemed like overnight, that thing, that imaginary binding that held them vanished, and all the groups fell apart. But really, the truth is, there were people in there trying to break that apart and trying to be free long before most of the world took notice of the struggle.
Yeah, I mean, Croats had been, you know, they felt completely undermined by Belgrade for the entirety of their involvement in Yugoslavia, you know, even before World War II. And their rebellion against Belgrade was so extreme that when they had a chance to rebel, they did it by just butchering every Serb they could find. And not every Croat did that, of course, but the desire for independence was that strong. And the real thing that made it happen, though, was not the Croatian separatists. It was just the fact that the central government in Belgrade kept overplaying its hand and just acting as though they could just pretty much do anything they want. And it's more complicated than that, because it really, as I think about it, you know, Milosevic he was a cagey player, and he didn't overplay his hand at every occasion. There were various points in time where he would pick what would be considered a more cautious approach, you know, toward getting what he wanted. He was nothing like the current United States federal government in the sense that it doesn't even think twice about anything that it does. It's like there's no caution that's ever crossed the mind of anyone that's in Washington now. It's a different, I mean, I think it was different in the 1990s, where Washington was more cautious. But something has happened in Washington where they've gotten, like, if you look at Milosevic and say he's a wild man dictator going out and slaughtering a lot of people and doing crazy things, he was much more cautious than what Washington is today. And he killed a lot fewer people than Washington has killed in its unnecessary wars against Muslims. So I start to think about all these bad things about Milosevic, and as I start to articulate them, I keep realizing how they're not as bad as what the current government in Washington is doing.
And Milosevic has been tried for was tried for war crimes.
Yeah, and he deserved to be tried for war crimes. He, you know, he was awful. I don't know if that's ever going to happen to the people that really deserve it, and that's the folks in Washington. We don't live in the same America that we lived in the 1990s. There was a time when America was the country that went in and stopped things like Yugoslavia. This is America. What we do today, that's America being Yugoslavia. The idea of endless wars in foreign countries, killing, especially targeting Muslims, that's just straight. That's again very similar to Milosevic and the old Serbian Republic inside Yugoslavia. We're treating the world the way Slobodan Milosevic treated the rest of Yugoslavia, except that the Americans have complete hubris. Milosevic didn't have that. He was at least ready to look out there and say, if I do this, I might die, so I won't do this. The Americans don't think that way. The federal government in America does not think that way. It never crosses their minds that they could ever be the bad guy or that they could ever be called on what they're doing or that there could be any price. They think there'll never be any price for anything that they're doing.
I think what brings that to stark reality is watching Obama tear up over the children being killed in that horrible massacre back in December, and then the fact that he kills children for a living. That's what he does. He can tear up on the camera and, you know, all of America goes, oh, we have such a good president. But he kills children for a living. He sends with a flick of his finger, he sends a bomb into a whole group of people that might have one bad guy. You know, we're told that there's a bad guy there. And it doesn't matter that there might be numerous families at that same location. He doesn't shed one tear for that. He doesn't blink. He's convinced that, that there's no repercussions at all for his actions. And he kills. And it's not just Obama. I mean, it's not just the Democrats or the Republicans or it's the entire mentality of the government in Washington, D.C.
It's important to put this sort of thing in context and not judge more harshly than we should. I'm someone who doesn't get particularly angry about the American involvement in World War II or the American involvement in the Cold War, at least parts of it, where you did have situations where, you know, Americans were dropping bombs and children were accidentally dying. But this was part of a process that was supported by the locals, right? I mean, liberating France was generally supported by the people of France, and it was a brief process. It did not last for 10 years. It was war. It was done. It was waged as quickly as it could be waged and finished as quickly as it could be finished within the bounds of political reality, right? That's how they did World War II. That's how they did World War I. That's how the Americans fought in Bosnia, too. This, what they do now, is something completely different. This is the kind of warfare that Sun Tzu warned against. It's the endless war. And he said, no nation has ever benefited from prolonged warfare. So how can the people at West Point who teach Sun Tzu not be listening to Sun Tzu?
I think there's a very serious disconnect with I try not to criticize the military all that much. I know that there are people who strongly believe that you have to support the troops and everything like this. But I think there's a disconnect within the military between people, you know, doing their duty, so to speak, or as they call it, doing their duty, and individual human beings saying to themselves, if I continue obeying orders and doing exactly what I'm told, I'm in the process of destroying the very thing that I've sworn myself to protect. And I think that's the disconnect that's happening right now in the U.S. military.
Yeah, and there's an even bigger disconnect, I think, in the hearts of the American people in many cases, where you just have this knee-jerk reaction that automatically someone who joins the military is doing good stuff. I mean, there was an element of truth in that 15 years ago, but this is a different America. It has changed dramatically. And there are people who were overseas for longer than me that have seen it much better than I've seen it. I think this Chris Shays, I'm trying to remember the name of this reporter, I think, with the New York Times, who had been overseas for about 20 years, since you know, around 92 until recently. And he goes on and on about it. I mean, how he cannot believe this is the same country that he left, you know, to do his work overseas in 1992. And I think the people who live here, it's changed more. It seems like a slower type of change when it's happening day by day, as opposed to coming back after 20 years like Rip Van Winkle. And it's in a dramatic change. It is the change from good to evil, practically. I mean, I cannot get my mind around how decent the country was in the 90s compared to what it is today. I still support, to some extent, a lot of what the federal government did in the 90s. I don't like the funding mechanism, but I can't really completely fault a lot of the things that they did. I just think of myself as like a loyal 1990s American, right? Stuck into this dystopian America that was born out of the original.
We have about 2 minutes left in this segment before we break off for a commercial. So I would do injustice to my listeners if I didn't talk more about the Ridley Report, what it is you do up there in New Hampshire, and really how fun it is to watch a Ridley Report. If you've never gone to YouTube and you've never watched a Ridley Report, I don't know how to explain it other than fun. It's Dave, you just engage your viewer and bring them right into your world, and your sense of humor is so bizarre and wonderful at the same time. I just really appreciate watching your YouTube videos.
Fun. Well, that's the second nicest thing anyone's ever said about the Ridley Report. I appreciate that.
Well, let's break here for a commercial, and I'll save this file in case Skype decides to die on us. And if all goes well, folks, come back in 30 seconds or 60 seconds, and we'll have more with Dave Ridley.
Do you have an Amazon account? If you don't, let me encourage you to set one up. Setting up an account is free and it's easy, and Amazon has great prices, and in most cases you can avoid paying sales tax. Plus, if you're careful and lump your purchases together, you can get free shipping. And Amazon has almost anything you can think of, plus it's safer and cheaper than driving all over town. When you buy stuff, if you follow the Amazon link at badquaker.com, Amazon will give Bad Quaker a tiny portion of the purchase. It won't cost you any extra, but you'll be supporting this podcast. Thank you.
Thanks for sticking with us through the commercial break. Ben Stone with Bad Quaker Podcast here with Dave Ridley on the phone. Dave, you're in New Hampshire right now, right?
Correct.
And how long have you been in the Free State Project, and how long have you been in New Hampshire?
I joined the project in 02, and I've moved to New Hampshire in 04, about 8 or 9 months after the state was chosen. And so I guess I've been here 8 years.
So you were one of the very early waves of people moving in.
I think I was the 50th mover. There were 250 people who already lived here before the state was chosen. So I guess I became what they call Free Stater number 300.
Wow. You're the
now
old
there
guard.
Are, well, I mean, Free Stater in New Hampshire number 300. Now there's, I guess, more like 1,200.
Now, at times, and this is one of the things I really appreciate with your with the Ridley Report, and there are times when there's this tendency for everybody to walk in lockstep and say, you know, this is how we're doing it. Everybody does, you know, civil disobedience in this method and so forth. And you have at times clarified the situation and said, look, guys, you know, I appreciate what you're doing, but think about this as a possible better method to accomplish your ends. And you've given some really, really good advice sometimes, but sometimes that advice is not necessarily appreciated as much. I've seen some people on Facebook get pretty nasty with you, but you always maintain such a good attitude, and I appreciate that so much from you, Dave.
I don't think people generally get angry at me for offering advice on how to do it better. Maybe a little bit But what people do get angry about inside the movement, people sometimes, is that they think I go too far with the transparency thing. Kind of like I hear something going to happen, like I see somebody post something on a Facebook page. I'm planning on lying down in front of the Bearcat. So I do a bulletin. So-and-so is planning on lying down in the Bearcat. Oh, my God, somebody, you know, really reported that someone's going to lie down in front of the Bearcat, and he was just putting it on the Facebook page that was only visible to 400 people. You know, what happens if the government finds out about this, you know, the fact that he's planning to lie down in front of the Bearcat? You know, this wasn't supposed to be public yet. We only informed 400 people. You know? So it's kind of like that. That's what people would get angry about, something like that. And I'll be like, well, if I had known that this is not, like, not public, I guess I might have held back on reporting it. And that's what always happens, it seems like, is I don't know something's private. It looks pretty public to me, and so I just go ahead and talk about it. And, oh, you weren't supposed to talk about that. That's the kind of negative reaction I'm most likely to get from inside the movement.
Like the government doesn't know what we're doing all the time anyway, or maybe I'm just too paranoid about that. But now, Dave, you, can I exploit your wonderful musical talents to have you composed a piece of music in honor of badquaker.com? Would you be interested in sharing that with our listeners?
I didn't really compose it. It just sort of happened to it. You know, I was just trying to dial your number, and it just kept coming to my head. But yes, I'll sing it for you. Quaker, 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 bad, 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 Quaker, 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 bad, 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 Quaker.
John Lennon could not have done any better.
Pretty good, huh?
It's a work of art. You know, that's how Mozart, that's how he composed.
It would just come to him.
Yeah, yeah, just like that. Yeah. You either have it or you don't.
Yeah, but it didn't sound like that.
So, Dave, for people who have never watched one of your videos, describe for our listeners what they're going to find when they go over to YouTube and click on one of your videos.
Well, they're going to find really low-budget videos. And there's always something missing from a video that I do. For YouTube, because I look at it like Robert Plant used to say was when he was in Zeppelin. He used to say, you know, like they would go to the studio and he would sing something and he'd make a mistake, and they'd say, "Well, it's rock and roll. Just leave it in. We don't need to spend the extra $300 an hour to fix it. So just leave it there, and we'll go on to do the next song." And he was right. You know, it's just rock and roll. Video on YouTube is just video on YouTube. It doesn't need to look like CNN. It doesn't need to have high production values. It's good if it's interesting, that there's no boring parts. The rest of it doesn't really matter. Each of my videos sacrifices something, like leaves something out in order to reduce production time. But I try to make sure I always leave something out that I can leave out without making it boring or bad, you know, right? So, for instance, I might go and to an event and videotape it. Well, I just don't bother to edit it. I just throw the raw video on the air. And I think that way, as I'm shooting it, just try to keep the shots short and don't shoot anything that's boring. Take some interesting shots. Do some very short interviews. Slap that on the air raw. I've skipped the editing process. But because I've been very careful about what I shot, there's really not anything boring in there, hopefully. And if I'm not at an event and I'm just editing something, well, I might skip a different aspect. Like, I might not write a script. I might just blabber into a microphone and then slap some video on that, throw that on the air. Again, as long as there's not too much that's not interesting, your YouTube video is fine. And that's the way I look at it. Just skip some of this fancy stuff that's not going to get you any extra attention, and focus on what's interesting, slap it on the air, get something on the air every day.
Also, something you do in your videos is you talk very casually to the listener kind of like, you know, they're a friend, they're there with you, they're seeing what you see, and you're explaining to them what's going on. And I think it really gives it a personal touch that makes the person viewing the video really puts them into it.
That's good. Yeah, that's good. I hadn't thought about it that way, but the there's a writer named Kashif, you know, who used to produce for Whitney Houston and some other even bigger stars, and people used to say that about him. And you read his books, which are just books about how to make a buck in the music industry. He sounds like he's writing directly to you. And really, a lot of reporters have that talent, and you can find that in them as you work with them. Like, a lot of the neatest people that you'll meet are mainstream press reporters, or at least, well, back in the day when I was in the mainstream press. It's changing, you know, it's all changing for the worse for a while anyway. But back in the day, you know, when the press was still the press, there were some really interesting and fun people that worked in newsrooms. And I used to go out, like, there was one reporter I went out with. The space shuttle fell. The space shuttle blew up above my apartment back in 2003, right? You know, I lived in Dallas. Right above my apartment was where it blew up. And it scattered debris all over East Texas. The station sent me out to East Texas. I was working as a videographer for them. And I'm chasing space shuttle parts for a week. And I was with this reporter from Louisiana. He was one of the most interesting people you'd ever talk to. He just had a way with words. He was a lot of fun. He didn't take anybody seriously. He didn't believe anything the government said. It's just what you want a reporter to be. And it was so fun to listen to him talk about the crazy feds that he had run into all over East Texas, right? You know, while this was going on. But as soon as he would get on camera, he would just parrot the federal line. Thou shalt not pick up pieces of thy space shuttle. It is sacred, and thou shalt go to jail. You know, thou shalt not run thy business if thou hast had pieces of our shuttle land near your business. Thou shalt do nothing, thou shalt shut thy business. And it was just so night and day listening to the real him and listening to the him that he felt he had to be while he was on camera, you know? And I thought, wouldn't it be better if I could just capture the real reporter, right, and throw him on the air? Well, I can't do that, but I could capture the real me and put the real me on the air.
Did, during that time, were you ever an on-air talent, or were you just strictly behind the camera?
I was not on air at Channel 4. I was on air at Channel 51. I worked in Longview, Texas. My first job was a reporter. Well, I was like what they call a one-man band, so it was a reporter / photographer. I did a little bit of anchoring, but it was just this little tiny market. Nobody watched us. It was a terrible station back in those days. And I was just like, I was a reporter for 9 months in front of the camera. But I had to carry, you know, 50 pounds of gear with me everywhere, and it was awful equipment, and my reports mostly looked pretty awful. And so it was just kind of like a starter thing where I was having to do both reporting and videography. But as soon as I got a chance, I jumped to a station that just let me just concentrate on the videography. That was more interesting to me at the time.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with them or not. The Freedom Fiends have a podcast, and one of the guys in the podcast is Nima Vedati. And he was a on-air talent in a couple different TV stations. And he just got to the point of where I hope to have him on the podcast pretty soon. And I'll actually have him explain this. It'll be better in his words. But he got to the point of where he just couldn't be on the camera pretending to be that person that they demanded that he be. He had to step away from it because he couldn't... you know, he couldn't live with himself making this false image constantly. Do you think there's a lot of that in the news industry, or are most of them just numb and they don't care?
There must be. I never really felt that when I was in the business too much myself. I mean, like me being forced to be something I wasn't. But I could see it happening to the reporters. I was only a reporter, you know, for my first job. So it's complicated because it depends on what you mean by a reporter, because a lot of times, like later on in my career, I would go out and I would go to a scene by myself and I would do everything and I would write the script, and I would do all the work, and I would just hand it over to whichever anchor wanted it, you know, and they would read it, and then I'd edit it. It was all me with their voice, and that was a real win for everybody because I got complete control over the story, but they also got to throw their name on it, and I didn't want to voice it. You know, I didn't want to create a new personality or be a reporter. It would, they have the established voice, and theirs was the best voice to go on that story in many cases. But back to, I'm losing track a little bit of what was the question that you asked?
If you think that there's a lot of, or at least a good portion of the, you know, the actual on-air talent that have this problem with making, almost making a split personality where they have to be one thing on the air. And
there was a guy who wrote an article about that. I can't remember where it appeared. It was a pretty major magazine. I remember it was passing all over the station at Channel 4 when I used to work there. But it was some guy who worked for like a mid-market station as an anchor, and he quit his job because he got tired of being told he had to fit into this, you know, kind of one-size-fits-all box. He was told that one of his grievances was that he was told he should be quiet about his support for Ayn Rand. He was an Ayn Rand, you know, devotee or whatever they call those objectivists. He was supposed to be quiet about that. Because she was an atheist. So, it's like, how vanilla do these people have to be, you know? Because most of them are not, you know, people are not drawn to journalism because they're bland. They're drawn to journalism because they like excitement and they want to see the world and share the world and maybe change the world. But yeah, they get into this sort of straitjacket, where they want Ken and Barbie, and not everybody's Ken and Barbie. Why should everybody have to be Ken and Barbie?
I've been pretty critical at times with on-air news people because oftentimes they're reading their script. They're paid to read the script that they're reading specifically because they can look good while reading a script. It's not because they're, you know, experts on a particular topic. But I've often been critical with them for knowing so little about the things that they're talking about. I was watching some show that was just on. I wasn't actually watching it. I was in the room where a TV was on and the show was playing. But I think it was one of the morning TV talk things. And they had like three people sitting there chit-chatting while they're telling the different stories of the moment. And the story came up that some programmer had created a program that took the Van Gogh's self-portrait and then made an actual picture out of Van Gogh's self-portrait so that you look at it and you're looking like, it's like you're looking at an actual photograph of Van Gogh. And as they went through the story, two of the three people on air, it became clear that neither of them actually knew that the picture was Van Gogh or who Van Gogh was, or, you know, they... And I thought, well, actually, I said it. I stopped, and I was probably offensive to everybody around me. But I said, how stupid are these people? And then it dawned on me, well, not everybody knows who Van Gogh was.
Yeah, not stupid. They were just ignorant of that one thing. And there's a lot of stuff that I'm ignorant of that the average person knows a lot about. You know, so I'm reluctant to judge. That's one picture I guess I would recognize, but there's a plenty I wouldn't.
I suppose that's why I'm the bad Quaker, because I'm not supposed to judge people like that. As a Quaker, we're supposed to accept them as they are without demanding that they know particular pieces of information or that they, you know, believe certain things or whatever. But sometimes I fail utterly at that task, and sometimes I just shake my head and think, I'm in a world by myself here.
Yeah, I guess that's how all liberty people feel, or at least we used to, but now it seems like we are kind of coming together, at least geographically, to some extent. And by the way, speaking of which, why aren't you in New Hampshire yet?
Well, I will be for the New Hampshire Liberty Forum, and we plan to be for the Pork Fest as well. But it's, my wife doesn't like cold weather, and New Hampshire gets cold sometimes.
You're planning on moving?
No, we're just going to be there for the two events, the Liberty Forum and Pork Fest. But yeah, we probably would move if it weren't cold there in the winter.
Well, what about the migratory thing? What about, you know, just like officially living here but escaping for 4 or 5 months out of the year, you know, by, you know, living as an SKP in an RV or something?
That's actually something that I plan on convincing my wife is a good idea at some time. I don't know if I'll accomplish that task. She has a very, you know, strong mind of her own, and I have very little influence on it. But that's something I hope that this tour, this winter that we're on right now, that I can use as fodder in the argument to convince her that that's a good idea.
Well, you know, going back to the first part of our discussion, you know, earlier, we were talking about Yugoslavia. It mattered which part of Yugoslavia you were in when the end came, right? You don't want to be in the wrong part of the United States when the United States falls. And New Hampshire is, I think of it as America's Slovenia. If you think about the Slovene situation in former Yugoslavia or the Estonian situation in the former Soviet Union, these places that were in the north, that were very peaceful, you know, low crime rates, peaceful resistance to the central authorities, independence movements, ethnically homogenous, those were the safe places to be, no matter who you were, when the end came.
That's kind of the feeling I had during Porkfest 2012. It was kind of like once I got in there, you know, into the mountains and into the valleys of northern New Hampshire, I felt like almost like the state couldn't get to me. I know that's just my imagination, but it was just the feeling I had.
It was true that week. They couldn't get to you that week.
Dave, let me save this file here real quick, and we'll throw a commercial in here for the folks to listen to, and we'll be back in about 30 to 60 seconds.
Would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you.
Thanks for sticking with us through the commercial break. Dave Ridley on the line with me on Bad Quaker Podcast. Now, we were talking, right before the break, we were talking about the feeling that you get in New Hampshire during Porkfest. To me, it just felt like maybe for the first time since I was a kid that I was free of the state. How often do you get that feeling, Dave?
A feeling that the government can't come and get you, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, like you can just function on a day-to-day basis without having the government thumb right on top of your forehead.
Right. It is that way for that 1 week during Porkfest in northern New Hampshire. The authorities can watch you, and I believe they have been watching us at Porkfest, but they can't really make a move at Porkfest, right? That would be just, it would be a nightmare. They would probably have people lying down in front of their vehicles by the dozens, right, if they tried to ever arrest someone and drive them out of the facility. So they would not make a move during Porkfest. You're perfectly safe for that 1 week. What happens after that and before that is going to be different. But you do have a sense that this small space and time has sort of been carved out for you, for the liberty lover. The beleaguered liberty lover in this authoritarian country that we have come to live in, there is that ability to carve out a little bit of space and time. Later on, maybe we can carve out more space and more time.
One thing that they have shown that they will do is they wait until all of the whole Free State Project and all the visitors to Porkfest leave. And then they go in and threaten the owners of the campground. I thought that was particularly cowardice of them.
Right, and the owners, it's just like so many, I get so frustrated when I hear about these stories. You mean to tell me that an agent of the government came to your campground to tell you what to do and you didn't get video of it. And that's how, it, you know, that the guy who runs the campground is awesome. But the average person just doesn't think to pull out their video camera, get video of it, put it on YouTube, and document the whole process. They let it happen quietly. And, or worse, they let it kind of fall between the cracks between quiet and well-publicized. I just wish that everybody was documenting everything that happened to them, that the government does to them. And that's what the government is afraid of, is the spotlight.
I was talking to Derek J. Freeman in a previous interview, and we were talking about how something I say pretty regularly is that the thing that that people who support the state, some of them understand this, that the moment that the bulk of people come to realize that there is a thing called the state, but it only exists in their imagination, that really it's just a, you know, it's an agreed upon myth, and it's based on aggression. It's based on dominating, on one group of people dominating everybody else. Once that comes to light, and once people see that, it's like a death sentence to the state, because most people, when they fully recognize what this myth of the state really is, their knee-jerk reaction is to resist it or to realize that it's bad and it's not necessary.
I don't know that thinking of it as a myth is really all that appropriate, but focusing on the aggression is very appropriate. I mean, I was having a conversation with a relative, you know, a while back who was an Obama supporter, and, you know, we'd had many conversations over the years. It just never seemed to go right, and I thought, you know what, I just need her to know one thing, and just let this thing sit in her mind and grow. I just need her to understand that I have a problem with acts of aggression. It's really all it is. Everything else is just window dressing on that simple fact. If I have a problem with something, it's because there's an act of aggression. And you don't have to see it right now. You don't have to understand it or agree with me. I just need you to understand that this is the root of my concern. I have a problem with acts of aggression. Just know that. That's all I needed to hear today. We don't have to talk any more politics this year. Just know that for the rest of our lives, you need to understand I have a problem with acts of aggression. And that's all I need her to know. She'll start to understand more and more, I think, about what my troubles are with the authorities, what my grievances are with the authorities. When she plugs that in, where's the aggression? Is there aggression here or not? You know,
I really think that's critical, because that really is what it all boils down to. You know, I try to talk on my podcast as much as possible about the zero aggression principle, or the non-aggression principle, whichever you prefer to call it. But that really is, I think, the core issue is look and see, is there aggression? And don't just look on the surface. Look beyond. Is this supporting aggression? Is it based on aggression? Would it be here if it weren't for aggression? If it weren't for aggression, would we have this? And if you can't answer that honestly, and if you can't say, you know, that this thing lacks aggression, therefore it is good, really it's a moral position that I don't know how a person can make an argument and say, well, you know, most of the time aggression's not good, but when it benefits me, then aggression's good. Well, that's what the basic criminal would say to himself.
Yeah, and this is even worse, usually, because almost anything that the government does that's really great is actually worse than shoplifting, right? Because it's, you know, it's done to a large number of people. For instance, if you think about the federal government back over all the years of its existence, what's the most impressive thing it's ever done? My best guess would probably be that the most impressive thing it's ever done was the defeat of Nazi Germany, right? But even that contained various acts of aggression, not just the bombing type, but the fact that they had to use aggression against the taxpayer to make their war successful. At least they thought they did. I believe that there are ways to wage warfare without taxation. There are certain ways that Hitler could have been fought
maybe successfully, without any taxes being used. But there was at the root of that great act of Patton's, you know, rush on the Western Front and you know, D-Day and all these other things that are so enshrined in American history. At the root of that, though, the way it was funded was aggressive. It just, there's got to be a way to fix these problems in the world without having to use aggression. Maybe warfare is sometimes necessary, but there's got to be a way to do it without aggression. And that, so that's what I always look at, that where, you know, where is, you know, is there, I guess I'd say, is there aggression in this thing that you favor, the waging of World War II or World War I or the war on poverty or you know, any federal legislation?
For my generation, I think I'm a little bit older than you. I don't think I'm a whole lot older than you, but for my generation, the big thing that would probably pop into everyone's head would be, oh well, you know, America went to the moon. But even with that, even that seemingly benign incident, or not incident, event, even that was entirely funded by aggression for the purpose of intimidating the Soviet Union, to show them, hey, we have better rockets than you have. We have more control with, you know, we can put a rocket exactly where we want it. We can fly it around and around and around and around as much as we want, and then put it right down your throat if we need to. That was the underlying thing that was spoken by some, but mostly the public didn't understand that. They thought we were doing some great noble deed in going to the moon. But in all actuality, it was almost a military exercise to intimidate the Soviet Union at the expense of millions and hundreds of millions of Americans that were paying for it. When, you know, the upside, the few things that were invented, like, you know, ballpoint pens that write upside down, and, well, okay, that's great, but we also have pencils that'll do that. You know, many of the things that either wouldn't, they claim, wouldn't have been invented if it weren't for the moon project, how do we know they wouldn't have been invented? Or how do we know something else wouldn't have? I mean, that it's not a logical argument.
The Washington government doesn't get us into space. The Washington government is the reason we can't get into space. You and I have no hope of probably ever going to space in our lifetime, and it's because of the Washington government. It will come and arrest you if you try to get to space, right? I mean, there is nothing you can do anywhere in the country unless you have, you know, probably billions of dollars. You're not going to be allowed to build anything that can get to space.
That's very true. Most people don't realize that in the 1930s, the federal government decided that two things, computers and rocket ships, rocket power specifically, could not be trusted in the hands of your average Joe American. And the government held a stranglehold on the monopoly of technology in the fields of rocketry and computers for many years. They kept that monopoly on computers up until the late 60s, when they just simply couldn't hold the monopoly any further because of tinkerers in garages that the government couldn't control, and thus we have the internet and everything around us. But that monopoly on the control of rocketry, who knows where we'd be right now if the government had not outlawed individuals from tinkering and experimenting in the field.
Right. I mean, I guess they like banned Boeing from exporting its launchers to its own launch site, because, you know, the launch site was outside the country's borders because it's less expensive to launch from the equator. And Boeing wasn't allowed to get into space. You know, I'm sure they figured eventually some way around it. But imagine all the money that went down the lawyer pit, down the regulation pit. That's money that could have been invested in something that would produce something. Instead, it went to lawyers, right? And it's just so maddening. And then people look at now, oh, look, NASA, they got their space shuttle. You know, it flew, and it only cost $300 an ounce to get everything into space. And isn't it too bad that it costs so much? But it always will, because that's just the way it is. Yeah, it's maddening.
when the free market, who knows how it would have done it or when, but the free market would have made it profitable.
Well, yeah, of course, there have been, some of the rich people have been allowed to develop limited, you know, like non-orbital stuff. You know, and there's that Spaceship One, which goes up and down, and it, you know, I guess they did that for millions of dollars. I think that's like that's a $20 or $30 million project. It's not orbital, but it's really a pretty reasonable price to get something that's so close to being a full-fledged spaceship.
Again, though, there's levels and levels of permission that you have to go through, and, you know.
There is a guy who was building a spaceship in his backyard about 10 years ago, and then there's others, I think, besides him. There's also something going on in Denmark, and this may, I maybe should correct myself when I talk about them stopping everybody. They're not stopping this company in Denmark that is operating on a shoestring budget. I'm sure they don't have billions of dollars. And I can't remember the name of the company, but they're trying to just use this completely off-the-shelf stuff like hair dryers and, you know, just other stuff that you'd get at the store to make spaceships with. And they've actually had these various test launches with crash dummies and so forth. And they're aiming, again, sort of at that Spaceship One type up and down approach that's not orbital. And I think the word suborbital may even be in their name. And really, I'm not sure there's a huge amount of value in that because you really got to get to orbit. And I'm not sure if they're prevented by, you know, the UN or the US from making something orbit. But it just seems like everybody's trying to make something that doesn't orbit. It's like only Washington is allowed to orbit anything. Right? I hope there's something else is underway that I haven't heard of that's focused more on orbital technology. I hope that the authorities are not completely squashing it.
One area, and I've talked about this quite a bit, one area that I am encouraged by is the food trucks that so many people have just decided to, you know, they're tired of fighting with all the regulation in the restaurant industry. And so with a relatively small investment compared to a brick and mortar restaurant, they get themselves a food truck, and you can very easily fly under the wire on that and, you know, and make a decent living while not being subject to the whims of a lot of regulators. You might have to move around a bit. But if you're willing to take the risk, that's one method that people are using to get a little bit of liberty in their business.
Well, Americans would be crawling all over the solar system in food rockets if it weren't for Washington.
Food rockets. I have to remember that. Maybe I'll peel that little quote out and put that by itself.
You know,
Dave Ridley.
And that's the other thing. They wouldn't probably be rockets because that's another thing Washington has heavily regulated. In fact, I guess they've completely banned it or made treaties that prevent it. But there are more nuclear type technologies that were available in the 60s where you could go into space and not have to, you know, use any explosives. You just had the nuclear power device that would take you there and back, you know, and would just provide constant power. And the fear of nuclear fallout has prevented those from being developed safely or developed at all. But the whole idea of going into space on these explosives, you know, like these huge mounds of explosives that you have to have under your craft to get into space, that's artificial. That's forced by Washington. You know, the natural way that one would get into space would be to use nuclear power. It's not allowed yet.
Yeah, or even possibly even some type of lighter than air device to get up high enough to where you could then, you know, thrust the rest of the way out into space. Because getting up the first, you know, 150,000 feet or so is where the real difficulty is.
Yeah, I wonder why they haven't experimented with that. That's obviously safe to use a helium balloon to get up that far. I don't understand. It's just, but again, there's not much competition. Washington has a monopoly on space to some extent. The European Space Agency does some stuff. The Russians still do some stuff. But the competition is gone. This is what I just didn't, it never occurred to me back in the 90s that this would happen with the defeat of the Soviet Union. I never thought I would miss the Soviet Union, but the lack of competition that Washington has out in the world right now is part of what has made Washington become so evil. When they had the Soviets to compete with, they had more of an incentive to be the good guy, I guess, even though there were some brutalities definitely involved in the Cold War. There's just something that's completely changed about Washington, and I guess that must be part of it, just the lack of competition.
That's a really good point. Yeah, and unlimited funding. I mean, it's, you know, the money doesn't cost them anything. They can, if they need more, they can either just extort more from us, or they can just print it and, you know, take it out of the economy that way. But either way, there doesn't seem to be any limit. Back in the day, there used to be, you know, people used to talk about reducing the size of government, and it seemed like they really meant that. But now that's almost a joke.
Right. It's going to keep growing until it collapses, just like the old Soviet Union. Again, I hope it's more like a Soviet collapse than a Yugoslav collapse, but who knows? It probably the safe bet is to expect that it will be a collapse that has elements of all the previous collapses, you know, like it'd be a little bit like the Ottoman collapse in 1918. It would be a little bit like the British collapse in 1947, or a little bit like the Soviet collapse in 91. It'll probably have elements of each one in it, but it's going to happen sooner or later.
That's kind of how we started this conversation, so that might be a good wrap up for it. That one possible way to find safety is to get yourself into a position where you can go to a place, if you're not there already, where there are other like-minded people, and the Free State Project fits that bill pretty nicely, doesn't it?
Right. I mean, you didn't want to live through Yugoslav wars in Sarajevo or Mostar, right? You wanted to be in Ljubljana, or you wanted to be in Zagreb, or some place that wasn't completely surrounded and burning down all the time. It's the same way in the United States. You want to be in a place where it's probably the northern places are probably better. The colder climates should be safer. Places that are ethnically homogenous would be safer for all ethnicities, hopefully. Places where the government is relatively small. New Hampshire fits pretty well into that. I mean, Idaho and Wyoming and Montana probably do as well. But, you know, again, if you look at the parallels in the Soviet Union, it's the same way the northern parts, Estonia, Lithuania, they did the best. It's the southern republics that got the worst dictators. So I think the place, you know, to be safe in America is further north, and New Hampshire is one of those places.
As we wrap it up here, Dave, other than your YouTube presence, which is, again, the Ridley Report on YouTube, what other places should people check on the Internet that you would recommend?
I think freekeen.com is consistently interesting. I don't really agree with the demeanor that a lot of freekeeners display. It's kind of a harangue-y, ideological, you know, type of whiny thing going. But it's very interesting. They've got content every day. They're keeping close tabs on the bureaucrats. They're going to almost all the different government meetings now, and they're really engaging constantly. Like, I wish, you know, I wish that every town in New Hampshire had a movement that was engaging as much as the Free Keeners are. But that's obviously based in Keene, New Hampshire.
Dave, thanks a ton for coming on the show with me today. It's been wonderful to talk to you, and hopefully we'll see you in about a month at the Liberty Forum.
Thanks, Ben. Planning on it.
And folks, thank you for listening today. And remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. And remember to click on the link in the upper right side of the of badquaker.com and hit that link for our forum. And get over there and take a look around. If it's something you like, be sure and make a login and join the conversation.